طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we want to explore the phenomenon of attempts by purveyors of the Zionist narrative to silence the voices of those who challenge that narrative, specifically the silencing of Jews who have been brought up in strong Jewish families, believing the myths and falsehoods upon which the Zionist narrative is based, who then, when confronted with the well-documented facts of what really happened in 1948, as confirmed by the Israeli New Historians, are transformed and take up the cause of setting the record straight within the Jewish community. Leah Tarachansky is one of those. Raised in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank, she not only broke with her Zionist roots, but currently works for the Real News Network, setting the record straight on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2013, she completed her work on her first feature documentary, On the Side of the Road. The film is an exploration of the power of denial. It questions what Israelis learn and choose not to learn about the 1948 ethnic cleansing, which led to the creation of the State of Israel. Leah's goal is to use the film to engage her Jewish community with the myth-puncturing truth concerning the establishment of the Israeli state. So our first presentation this morning is an interview with Leah Tarachansky on the Real News Network, where she discusses her attempts to show her film and engage her Jewish community.
Growing up in Israel, I learned that 1948 was a miraculous victory for us. I never heard about the people who lived here before, and definitely not about expulsions. After finding that clip, I searched for other veterans, but when I explained to them I wanted to hear about the other side of the war, most refused to speak with me.
Welcome back to the Real News Network, and welcome back to Reality Asserts Itself. We're continuing our series of interviews with Leah Tarachansky. She was the Real News Palestine-Israel correspondent. She's now the director of On the Side of the Road, a new documentary about Israel's biggest taboo, the denial of what happened in 1948. And she now joins us in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
So we've been talking about identity. We've been talking about Leah's own kind of arc of her own identity, and you really should watch the other segments because this then will make a lot more sense to you. So let's talk about Israeli identity today. I've been to Israel three times. Once when I was, about 14, and my sister had gone and she was living on kibbutz, and my father had just died, and I went there, and I was astounded at how I felt denigrated for the first time. As a Jew in Canada, I felt a little bit of it, but not much. But I was amazed on the kibbutz. I was treated as like a zero.
Why?
I wasn't, what's the term now?
Sabra?
Sabra. Mm. And I just, it was so much to me that I wasn't the born...
Explain that, though.
Well, this is if you're not born in Israel, explain to me. I mean, I just felt it, that they was...
You're an outsider?
Not interested in me. And they were trying to persuade me, maybe partly because I hadn't bought into the narrative. They were trying to say, no, you have to have Israel because all the Jews are going to have to come here someday to save themselves. And it's not that I hadn't experienced any anti-Semitism, but not... My identity was Canadian, not...
Mm.
And for those of you who are watching, you know I'm a dual citizen, and now I live in Baltimore, and so on.
So you're trying to sell your audience the narrative that at the age of 14 you had a political analysis?
No, I had an experience. Just okay. An experience. And I knew nothing going into it. I had the vaguest notion of what Israel was. It wasn't even on my radar. I went back again for a film festival, and then I went back again only three, 4 years ago. And over the arc of it, with just a little bit of that experience, I was just blown away at the overtness of the racism now. Mm. It would have been like during slave days, the way whites would have talked about blacks, like without any sense that you should even mitigate your language. How does it get to that point? What is it about where, in terms of the evolution of the Israeli identity, does this absolute overt racism come from? Because in the early days of Israel, I don't know, maybe a lot, some people certainly thought something like it, but they sure wouldn't have said it like that.
As a Israeli Jew, this is the stuff that keeps me up at night. Also, literally, there's I've been robbed of my anonymity on many fronts, and there's a lot of it that creeps into your life. But the way I understand it is it's a combination of two things. I think what you're seeing on the streets today in Israel, with the constant street-level violence and racism and attacks on anyone who questions anything, attacks on leftists, attacks on Palestinians, that it is the natural conclusion of the Zionist idea coming to its most screeching, screaming peak in having to defend itself. And this is part of the ethnocracy we're talking about. This is the natural conclusion. What is Zionism? Zionism is the idea that the Jews have a homeland in historic Palestine, in the ancient land of Canaan. That's spiritual Zionism. Practical political Zionism means that the Jews have more right to be on this land, and then they must be a Jewish majority on this land. How do you do that in a place that was never empty? In a place that was, first of all, was already home to competing national movements, that was already engaged in very rich in ancient culture, both from the Ottoman Empire and the Arab invasions, and this place is the crossroads of human migration. How do you come to this place, which is in the middle between Asia, Europe, and Africa, and you say, no more, here's our walls, and we're building a wall with Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and Egypt, and no one but Jews can get in, as I'm sure you know, there's no immigration to Israel unless you're a Jew. You can't immigrate, you can't come in. It's a state for Jews and only Jews, and we will eventually get rid of anyone who is not a Jew. That is political Zionism today. And the disparity between understanding that this is what it is here in the North America, as I'm touring my film and I'm realizing how few people understand what it is, and the reality on the ground, this idea playing itself out to its screeching peak, is the disparity is astounding, and the playing itself out is incredibly violent and intense. And so today, if I was to talk to you on the bus, or I was out walking down the street with you and I was saying all these things, there's a very good idea that we would be beaten by the time we get to the end of the street, because there is now so much threat to that idea surviving. So that's the first thing. The second thing is colossal disappointment over the so-called peace process finally completely dying. You know, there was a little bit of hope with Obama, Kerry, a little bit of hope with George Mitchell. It was kind of like no one really believed that they would do anything. But people said, well, at least something's happening. America, having taken the side of Israel on all of the peace negotiations, having put all its capital on the side of the Israeli negotiators, all of its weapons on the side of Israel's negotiators, and then sat in the middle calling itself the unbiased mitigator in this negotiation, which were doomed to end, gave us a false sense of hope. It has built endless institutions in Palestine. It built a government called the Palestinian Authority. It gave that Palestinian Authority billions in donations. And it's based on hot air and nothing else. And that thing finally collapsing now, over the last year, and the taking root of nonviolent movements, effective nonviolent movements, such as the fight of the Palestinian political prisoners with ongoing hunger strikes, such as the boycott movement and the anti-fascist movement inside of Israel, and the most important of which, the rising of national identity amongst Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, and inside Israel. And the linking of these three peoples, irregardless of who are their leaderships. This is the most important element in the picture. So the total disappointment with the peace process and the total the collapse of hope that the conflict will ever end gave a rise to a new kind of wave of understanding the conflict is never going to end. The generals and the capitalists that are sitting over there and are making money off the war don't give a shit about us. Israel saw a huge social justice movement that we've covered here in The Real News for 2 years. That social justice came and fell, and nothing changed, except there was a huge change in the public identity, in the public, the way the people see Israel, and the way that the people see that their fight is not just with the Palestinians, it's also with the government, and it's also with each other. It has further segregated us inside Israel. And so this, all these things together burst out. And if you look at, you know, people look at this war that happened this summer, this attack on Gaza, and they say, oh, it was really the worst attack on Gaza so far. They're right. But this attack was not just this summer. What happened this summer was, yes, 51 days of war, but it actually started not even with the teenagers getting kidnapped. It started with the Palestinian hunger strikers in the beginning of the year. What we were seeing in January a year ago is that the African refugees were rising up, demanding the freedom, because they were being shipped off to a massive prison in the south of the country, something very similar to a concentration camp for African refugees. So they were rising up, demanding freedom. The Palestinian hunger strikers went on a hunger strike and were very close to getting achievements with that hunger strike. Hamas was on the verge of signing unity with Fatah, which would have been the last thing that would have saved it. And this is when we went to war. So since then, and if you were actually following what's happening on the ground, like we were in The Real News, that's when the street-level violence started. And the war ended in the end of August, but the street-level violence never ended. In fact, it's getting worse day to day to day. You know, a few weeks ago, a Palestinian bus driver who drives an Israeli bus in an Israeli bus company called Egged was beaten to death and hung in the bus that he was driving.
Because?
Because he's Palestinian. This is one of the things. Now, there's no doubt in any Palestinian's mind that I've met that he was beaten to death and hung. But the police was claiming that he killed himself. And most Israelis believe that he killed himself. And this sparked a wave of bus drivers rising up against insecurity on the job, demanding that the bus company either separate them from the people who get on the passengers or get a security guard. Because the Palestinian bus drivers on the Israeli bus in the Israeli bus company were saying that they were experiencing daily racist attacks, daily racist assaults, and the company refused. And 40 of them have quit. So a third of the Palestinian workers who worked in the Israeli bus company quit because of racism and violence. That's where we are today. So 6 months of endless street-level violence.
Are there internal factors that you can see amongst Jewish Israelis that will change things?
Yeah.
Like I interviewed quite a few families who lost people in 9/11 in New York. And I was told at least half the families either joined or supported the Not In My Name campaign. They didn't want revenge. They were saying, don't start another war. This is not going to bring my loved ones back. And they started getting their head around the context of why it happened. Mm-hmm. And there's other examples in the world, and including Palestinians who have lost children, but they get the context. They don't just want blind revenge. But one gets the feeling that in Israel, there's been kind of a tipping point where the majority, even a preponderance of people are saying, mm-hmm. they're out to kill us, let's kill them first, kind of end a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, the consensus in Israel has now, I mean, it's gotten so bad that the general consensus debates between expel the rest of them or kill the rest of them.
So, it's a real fascization of public opinion.
Well, we saw during the war protests where, I mean, you weren't alive in the 30s, but I'm sure you've seen a lot of archival footage, people holding up signs during the protest reading, one nation, one army, one leader.
Straight Hitler.
I mean, that's Mussolini, you know, that's Nazi Germany. I don't know what you can compare
so
that
where,
to.
So where are there factors for change within Jewish Israelis?
So I think that in America, in North America, there's a lot of this mentality of there's a problem, what's the solution? We are light years away from resolving the conflict. I think a lot of people here in North America think that we've always been in conflict, but if you look at the history of Israel-Palestine, the history of this specific geographical spot, conflict over the centuries has actually been an exception. Peace and coexistence has been the rule, and our conflict is only about 70 years old, and we've already gone through huge changes as societies, and so, you know, let's think a little bit before we start talking about solutions. But what I can tell you is that profound changes are happening inside Israeli society, putting aside the Palestinian conflict for a second, or the conflict with the Palestinians. Israel, as I'm sure you saw when you were there, is a very segregated society. You have the Russians here, you have the Ashkenazis there, you have the Mizrahim here, and then you have the Orthodox there, and the Ethiopians here, and so on and so forth. And inside the Mizrahim, you have the Persians, and then you have the Iraqis, and you have the Moroccans. And there's very little mixing. Israel has almost zero social mobility. If you are born poor, you will die poor. You will not come out of the ghetto. And the media in Israel focuses on a couple of neighborhoods in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And that's it. What happens outside of these communities? What happens in Haifa? What happens in Palestinian-majority towns? What happens in poor, peripheral, Mizrahi neighborhoods? Completely absent. That doesn't mean that nothing's happening. What is happening is that these segregated communities, and I think it's a result of the social justice movement that was in 2011, 2012, when we saw the biggest protests in the country's history. 500,000 people on the streets in Tel Aviv one night in a country of 7 million people. That's a lot of people on the streets. As a result of that, people started looking around them. And this, for the first time, identity politics is becoming something that is on the fore. So the Mizrahim are saying, the Jews of that came from Arab countries are saying, we've been oppressed all along for the Zionist Ashkenazi project. What about us? To the level of forcing the president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, to apologize for Ashkenazi European condescendence towards the Mizrahim, something that would have been unimaginable. We're seeing the Orthodox, you know, digging their heels further as new laws inspired by Yair Lapid's party, forcing the Orthodox to go to the army, makes them more united and further in conflict with the society. So a lot of these groups, for various complex reasons that we don't have time to discuss here, are getting more insular and more against each other. And so this is, I think this is a very important change. It's because for so many years, with the illusion of the peace process, we were not looking at the real problems inside Israel.
Well, I was going to say, somebody once told me, and I think when I was there for that film festival, that if it wasn't for the external fight with the Palestinians, Israel would rip itself to shreds, especially the secular Orthodox split.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is what we're seeing. Israel is now ripping itself apart, and fascism is celebrating in the ruins.
You've been on tour around North America with your film. Talking to a lot of North American Jews, what are you finding?
Well, I was telling you about the New York screening. I've had about 30 screenings in 40 different cities, a massive tour along the West and the East Coasts. And everywhere I went, I called up the organizers and I asked them to please contact the Jewish community in their town. I made my film not for people that agree with me. I made my film for people that could who are Zionists and unquestioning and questioning Zionists and North Americans and Israelis. I wanted people who would never see that kind of film to see that kind of film, because my film is not, you know, we're talking here a lot about politics and a lot about geopolitics and things like that. That's not what my film is about. My film is a personal story, and it's a story of denial. And this is the film that I wanted to show in the Jewish community centers, in the synagogues, and in these places where that we need to talk to one another. And everywhere I called the organizers and I asked, please invite the local Jewish communities, please invite the local synagogues, invite them, go get to them.
So did they come?
They did not come. By and large, almost nowhere did they come. In fact, we couldn't even get them to watch the film inside the organization to say yes or no. We had to beg them in almost most of the places to just watch the film. They would say no. And the most incredible thing happened in my New York University screening. The organizers took out a huge room for like 300 people, beautiful room overlooking the Empire State Building. And it was during the same moment as the Eric Garner indictment. So a lot of people went to the protest. But, you know, the room was, you know, mostly full. And as I'm running tech with the guy who's responsible for the room, because the DVD wasn't working, I see this group of, like young 20-year-old students come in with a banner. And I immediately felt like they came to protest the screening. So I ran up to them and I said, "I'm so happy you came. I see that you've come to protest. Is that true?" And they're like, "Yeah. Yeah, we've come to protest your screening." I'm like, "Great, I'm so happy you came. Let's go."
Protest against your screening.
Yeah, but they are the people I made my film for. I'm excited that they're there. I'm so happy they've come. Because they will come, they will see the film, and then we can have this conversation, these very difficult conversations, essential conversations. And I told them, "Okay, where can I put you that will make you most visible? Do you want to stand on the stage?" And they said, "No, we'll stand here on the side. We'll just be—it'll be a silent. It's not even a protest. It's just a silent demonstration." I'm like, "Great, let's use." So I put them out. You know, they pull out their banner. Their banner reads 856,000 Jewish refugees," referring to the hundreds of thousands of Jews who were displaced from North Africa and the Middle East as a result of Israel's creation. And I said, "This is an incredibly important point. You're onto something very important. And I'm really happy that you came, because the Mizrahi side to the whole Nakba conversation is a very important side." So I
just quickly say what Mizrahi is.
Mizrahi is Jews who came from the Arab world in North Africa, the people that they have come to talk about. And this is something they were saying a lot. They said, "We come here to show the other viewpoint." And I said, "Great, I'm looking forward to hearing that viewpoint in the Q&A after the film." And I apologize because I had to continue running, fixing the audiovisual. And finally we fixed it, the film starts running, and I noticed that they fold up their banner and they go. So, you know, they all go to the elevator, and so I run in the elevator, and the doors close, and it's me with like maybe 20 of these activists in the elevator, stuck for 10 floors, and I'm asking them, "Why are you leaving? You've come to protest the film. You have to see the film." And they said, no, we can't stay for the film." And, "Oh, I have something to do. Oh, I also have something to do." I'm like, "You can't all have something to do. At least one of you, please stay for the film." They would not stay for the film. You know, when we come out of the elevator, we end up standing in the lobby, and only one of the girls, most of them just ran outside, and one of the girls stayed with me, and we ended up talking back and forth for about 20 minutes, and we could talk to each other. She was saying a lot of these things that you hear a lot of. What about Hamas? What about Hamas? What about Hamas? We ended up talking a lot and breaking through. You know, she understood where I'm coming from. I understood where she's coming from. And I told her, "Can you stay? Can any of you please stay for my film? I want you."
Well, you threatened their very identity.
I didn't threaten anything. I was begging them to stay for the film.
No, but they think if the film is persuasive in any way, it threatens who they are. And they have to start thinking about
questions.
Who they are.
My film doesn't tell you what to think. My film asks questions. And this is the point. This is why I'm telling you this story. Is because 2 days later, the Jerusalem Post published an article by the father of one of these activists who was not at the event, describing what happened, having gotten none of the facts right. In his description, they came. They actually quote me saying something I never said, as if I said, "Oh, are you even allowed to protest?" I cover protest movements all day long. Why the hell would I say something like that? So they got all the facts wrong in the article, and they made it seem like they came to protest, and all of us were just standing there staring at them aggressively, and finally kicked them out. The complete opposite of what happened. So not only did they get the facts wrong, but they also got this most important thing wrong, is that they refused to watch the film. They don't know what they're protesting. They are looking at this conflict like so much on the anti-Zionist left in America as a soccer match where you have to take a side. You are either on this side or this side, and you have to dig in and you have to root for your team. And if you have a soccer match, you have a winner and a loser. And if we are the winners now, we have to maintain the victory, because if we ever lose, we will be on the losing side. This is madness. This is not what conflict are about. These are not two sides. Israelis and Palestinians are not two sides of a conflict between two nations. This is what was so disappointing to me about North America, because what these kids did by not staying to watch my film is that they mirrored exactly what my film is about. Knowing what questions you cannot ask of yourself, because you know that if you actually ask yourself these questions everything will unravel. All the lies that you were told along the path, all the half-truths, all the propaganda, all the things that you told yourself have to be true, because if they're not true, then nothing makes sense, all of that comes to an end. And you have to look at Israel from a sober perspective. And this is what I found here. At the very least in Israel, they come. I've shown the film to hundreds of people who are very much against the point of view of the film, and they had a very hard time watching it, but at least they come.
Right. Okay, if people want to see the film, what do they do?
Well, we're just finishing the tour, so unfortunately they can't. But they can buy a DVD, and we hopefully will have it on TV soon.
And where they can buy the DVD?
www.naretivproductions.com, narrativeproductions.com.
Okay, great. And for people in the Baltimore area, we're going to be screening it sometime in, I guess, the spring. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So Leah, as she said, wants to engage people. Certainly people view her film, or people have viewed this interview, or at any rate, anyone, but particularly North American Jewish people. So if you would like to engage with Leah, she will come back, and we will do a sort of live web thing where we do a live stream, and you can engage her directly. So if you want to take up Leah's challenge, please do, and we'll let you know when. Just write us at contact@therealnews.com, and we'll let you know when we're going to do it. Thank you for joining us on Reality Asserts Itself on the Real News Network.
That was an interview with Leah Tarachansky of the Real News Network discussing her documentary film, On the Side of the Road. Our second presentation features the remarkable story of what happened when Max Blumenthal, journalist and author, attempted to speak in Germany and the attempts by the Zionists to silence his critical voice. But Max Blumenthal would have none of it. Here is an interview with Max Blumenthal concerning his German experience.
Max, you just got back from Germany, where you went with Israeli journalist David Sheen. Why were you invited there, and why was your very first scheduled talk canceled only 15 hours before the event?
It was interesting arriving in Germany with the Jewish Israeli journalist David Sheen, and realizing that as a Jewish American, it was perfectly acceptable for the children and grandchildren of Nazis to call me an anti-Semite in Germany, because I've defined my Jewish identity outside the frontiers of Israeli nationalism. In Germany, anti-Semitism is defined as apparently anyone who is a critic of the Israeli government. And we quickly were targeted by an Israel lobby operation that deployed elements of the German left against us to shut down our talk at the main public theater in Berlin, the Volksbühne, and to attempt to shut down our planned event at the German parliament, where I was going to discuss the testimony I gathered and the evidence I gathered in the Gaza Strip during Operation Protective Edge of Israeli atrocities. And David Sheen was going to present his documentation of state-sponsored Israeli racism and mob violence during the war this summer. So that was really the conversation that these German politicians and Israel lobbyists were seeking to shut down under the cover of anti-Semitism, actually accusing us of abusing the memory of the Holocaust. So it was incredible to watch this unfold.
One of your main assailants there was a guy named Benjamin Weinthal, an American living in Berlin who works for the Neocon Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. It's a DC think tank funded by Sheldon Adelson. Max, talk about what this network's role is and why it was so instrumental in shutting you down.
Well, nobody in Germany, except for my hosts, knew who I was. And so the German left was relying on Benjamin Weinthal as kind of their translator. You know, the Green Party's Volker Beck of the Green Party, who's this German Gentile politician who denounced me as an anti-Semite, was relying on, you know, distortions and fabrications about me supplied to him by Weinthal. And, you know, it's not easy being green, as Kermit the Frog said, especially when you're a puppet for a right-wing Muppet like Weinthal. And that's what the German left became. Weinthal is a, you know, journalistic reject who found his calling as an Israel lobby operative in Berlin, funded by right-wing billionaires like Sheldon Adelson, who has said that he doesn't like journalism and has advocated the dropping of a nuclear bomb on Iran. Through the foundation of the Defense of Democracies, Weinthal's been planted in Berlin to basically orchestrate these kind of campaigns. And he called up Gregory Gysi, who was the faction chairman of the Die Linke Party, whose members had actually invited and hosted me and David Sheen, and told Gysi that we were going to compare Israel to Nazi Germany, which wasn't part of our presentation at all. Gysi immediately announced that he would shut down our event, and Weinthal proceeded to go to a series of other politicians who were connected to the Israel lobby, gathering these statements about our supposed anti-Semitism, published it in the right-wing Berliner Morgenpost, published it in the Jerusalem Post, and the scandal was manufactured, putting our hosts on the defensive. And, you know, our hosts, Inga Hoger and Annette Groth from the Die Linke Party's beleaguered anti-imperialist wing, which the Israel lobby is aiming to destroy, did very little to defend us.
You actually got a chance to confront Gregor Gysi in the German parliament. He actually locked himself in the bathroom, Max. He must have been pretty scared of you.
Well, after our event at the parliament, at the German parliament, which actually took place, David Sheen and I were able to present our testimony and evidence on what happened during the war in Gaza, something that the Israel lobby in Germany was seeking to prevent. We wanted to meet with Gregor Gysi, who is really the leader of the reformist wing of the Die Linke Party, the main left-wing opposition party in Germany, and has worked to reposition that party to support Germany's special relationship with Israel and to drive out the anti-imperialist elements that are in solidarity with Palestine in that party. And so to the last second, he was trying to shut down our event. And we had to switch rooms twice because of Gysi. And all I wanted to do was have a civil, private meeting with Gysi. He absolutely refused to talk to us after endorsing the entire campaign of incitement and slurs against us. And so when he burst out of his office and rushed by us, we confronted him, and I called him a coward, which he is. He rushed through a door, which turned out to be a bathroom, and slammed the door on David Sheen, screaming, "Aus! Aus!" And the scandal, now known in Germany as Toilettengate, was born.
Let's talk about another political movement in Germany, the anti-Deutsch movement. I mean, at face value, you would think that this would be kind of in line with the pro-Palestinian cause. It's a far-left party that rejects far-right politics, yet unequivocally supports the State of Israel, has aligned itself with the most far-right elements of the Jewish diaspora. How much influence does this group have in German politics, and what role did it play in smears against you?
Well, if the anti-Deutsch or anti-German movement sounds weird, if it sounds like something out of the Big Lebowski, it's because it is weird. I mean, Germany is just a really weird, parochial, in some ways intellectually backwards place. The anti-Deutsch movement has gained enormous influence through a group called Vox Shalom, which operates within the Die Linke Party and aims to crush people like our hosts from the party's anti-imperialist wing. It's actually a group that emerged from the Marxist, post-structuralist, left-wing intellectual circles in Berlin and aims to actually crush the left. In a lot of ways, it's like the neoconservative movement in the U.S., which also emerged from communist circles. It only has a few hundred members, maybe a few thousand members, but it bears a disproportionate influence on German politics by taking over the youth faction of Die Linke, Vox Shalom, the youth faction of the Socialist Democratic Party, and installing its members in the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, which is one of the most influential left-wing foundations in Berlin. And they really managed to amplify the smears against us, working through friendly politicians in the Die Linke Party. And what the anti-Deutsch movement represents is a fear, it emerged from a fear of a fascistization or a second Holocaust after reunification between the East and Western and West Germany after the Cold War. its members believe that the only way to fight anti-Semitism is to express unequivocal support for the state of Israel and any measures it takes against the Palestinians. They are also unequivocally pro-American, and because the United States is Israel's largest beneficiary and largest patron. And they have even celebrated the British firebombing of Dresden. So they're completely reactionary. They believe that attacks or criticism of global capitalism are actually attacks on Jews, suggesting in an anti-Semitic fashion that Jews control global capital. And so this group works within the anti-fascist left in Berlin at advancing reactionary right-wing positions and giving the pro-Israel lobby a base within the German left. And so it was through the anti-Deutsch elements like Bach Shalom that the attacks on us grew within the Die Linke Party. And it's through this very small but very powerful element that the anti-imperialist elements within the main left-wing opposition party in Germany are being driven out. This group is the anchor for the right-wing pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. Within the German left. And it's very complex and weird, but it needs to be understood.
And Germany surely feels, on the flip side, that it has a personal stake in protecting and defending the state of Israel because Germany sponsored the Holocaust. So what's your response to Germans' line of thinking that they have no moral authority to question what Israel does?
Well, in the 50s, Germany decided to pay reparations to Israel, the state of Israel, in order to obtain absolution for the crimes it committed against Jews, including many Jews who had nothing to do with Zionism and who did not immigrate to Israel. These Holocaust reparations funded the military regime that Israel imposed on the Palestinians between 1948 and 1966. Now Germany provides Israel with discounted Dolphin-class submarines with launching tubes specially retrofitted to launch nuclear weapons. It recently inked a deal with Israel to provide it with a 30% discount on corvette boats, which will be used to attack fishermen in the Gaza Strip, and to protect Israel's illegally obtained gas fields off of the coast of Gaza. The German government for the first time is initiating direct training between its troops and Israeli forces in counterinsurgency. And this is all done under the fog of Holocaust guilt and in the name of Holocaust reparations. I really don't see how this honors the memory of the millions turned to ash. If anything, it seems to be abusing their memory and perpetuating the racist spirit the racist spirit of the Holocaust against a ghettoized and racially outcasted population to perpetuate their occupation. That is something that I wanted to address in Germany. And just by simply embracing the universalist lessons of the Holocaust, Sheen and I, for simply declaring never again to anyone instead of never again only to Jews, were demonized as anti-Semites in Germany and boycotted as Jews.
And there has been a real rise of violent events in Europe perpetrated in the name of anti-Semitism. I mean, there was the Paris suburb being firebombed, a German synagogue being destroyed in recent months. How should European countries be responding to these types of events?
Well, we see there is a resurgence of anti-Semitism on some level, but there's also an exaggeration of anti-Semitism. And at the same time, Islamophobia, which is the flip side of anti-Semitism and embodies the same spirit, is downplayed. Most hate crimes in Germany are committed against Muslims, but we rarely hear about them. We rarely hear about the German government deporting thousands of Roma to Kosovo and other supposedly safe countries, which aren't even safe. But the way that Germany should respond is by adopting a holistic definition that operates under the frame of racism instead of anti-Semitism alone. A recent study, a study taken last week in Germany, showed that German citizens who are most supportive of Palestinian rights have the least anti-Semitic opinions. And so this is another reason why anti-Semitism has to be redefined into a kind of new anti-Semitism, which takes the form of criticism of the Israeli government. What the German government and the German mainstream refuses to look at is its own racism particularly against immigrants who may have German citizenship but don't have the same rights in the street. A perfect example of this is the Kilani family, a German family with German citizenship that was wiped out, one of the 89 families completely exterminated in the Gaza Strip during Israel's war this summer. And the German government did not issue any condolence for this family to Ibrahim Kilani, a German citizen. However, when two German citizens were killed on a airliner in eastern Ukraine that was probably shot down by Russian separatists, the German government rushed to issue condolences. So we can see the clear difference in how it treats its white citizens and Muslim immigrant citizens.
Max, let's talk about how the notion of anti-Semitism is getting redefined here in the U.S. A resolution was unanimously passed by the House in September of this year that praises Germany for its condemnation of anti-Semitism and calls on Secretary of State John Kerry to confront what it calls a dangerous trend. Do you think these laws could prevent criticism of Israel?
If you look at the language in this resolution, it is aimed at critics of Israel, and it conflates criticism of Israel with racism against Jews, which I consider to be anti-Semitic because Israel does not represent all the world's Jews. And it's anti-Semites who wish that it did so they could implicate all Jews in Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. So this is a really dangerous precedent. Again, it shows how anti-Semitism is actually being repackaged because in the United States, anti-Semitism almost doesn't exist. Even Alan Dershowitz has said that. And I'm a perfect example of Jewish privilege in the United States and how well Jews are treated and how far we've come. We're one of the most elite groups. And in a lot of senses, the Jewish establishment is wielding anti-Semitism to prevent criticism of our privilege and the way that we exercise it in order to support the occupation of Palestinians. This is, as I said, it's an incredibly dangerous trend. And if the United States was serious about confronting anti-Semitic groups, it would apply equal standards against, for example, neo-Nazis operating in eastern Ukraine, including neo-Nazi violent militias who wear swastikas and uphold flags that look very much like swastikas. But we recently saw the United States vote against a resolution at the UN General Assembly condemning Nazism, apparently for fear that this would limit its ability to support a Ukrainian government that is honeycombed with neo-Nazis.
I'm so happy you brought this up because you just wrote a piece for Alternet where you point out that an amendment to the 2015 NDAA that could have prohibited U.S. training and assistance to neo-Nazis and other extremists in Ukraine, it was not supported by the country's biggest Jewish lobbying groups. Why would they not support that?
Well, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which named me the number 9 anti-Israel, anti-Semite of 2013, tied with the African-American author Alice Walker and 8 slots behind Ayatollah Khomeini. The Simon Wiesenthal Center. Yeah. Well, I'm trying to be number 1 next year. I'm really ambitious. Along with the Anti-Defamation League, the shakedown racket of Abe Foxman, which would be better, should be known as the Defamation League. These two groups were approached by Democratic congressional staffers to support an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Bill, which funds the Pentagon. And it had been sponsored by Representative John Conyers, this amendment. And it called for cutting off all aid to neo-Nazi groups and anyone who had voiced support for violent radical right-wing extremism in Ukraine. Conyers saw this as a way of tamping down on tensions in eastern Ukraine. And it seems to make sense. I mean, why would we want to fund neo-Nazis? The Wiesenthal Center and the ADL explicitly rejected this amendment. They said they would not support it because they need to support the Ukrainian campaign against Russia. And that Svoboda and groups that are led by literal neo-Nazis, like Right Sector, have moderated their rhetoric because the Right Sector's leadership and Svoboda's leadership Tianbok recently met with the Israeli ambassador in Ukraine. So these pro-Israel Jewish establishment groups in Washington basically refused to support a bill that would cut off aid to neo-Nazis. It was stripped out of the amendment with no support, died a quiet death. And the Azov militia, which is a neo-Nazi militia which is fighting on the Eastern Front in Ukraine, whose members have swastikas on their arms, and whose leadership has now won seats in the Ukrainian parliament, in the party of Yatsenyuk and Poroshenko, are now, their financial feeding tube is still intact.
Very scary situation there, Max. I can't let you go without your thoughts on the Israeli cabinet approving a bill that would officially define the country as reserving, quote, national rights for Jews only.
Well, this brings into clear view the system that Israel has operated under since 1948, which is ethnocracy. This bill is merely declaratory, but it will strip away the veneer that has existed around Israel's system of apartheid for so long. And there are so many discriminatory laws that have passed since 1948. From the Anti-Infiltration Act, which defined Palestinians who once lived inside Israel as infiltrators instead of refugees and basically prevents them from living in Israel, to the Center of Life Law, which prevents any Palestinian living in Jerusalem who spends any period of time in the West Bank from retaining their residency in Jerusalem and is really driving a lot of the violence in Jerusalem right now. To the Acceptance to Communities Law, which was recently passed and allows communities of under 500 to discriminate on the basis of race and religion. This is official. There are so many laws discriminating against people on the basis of ethnicity and religion in Israel. And this new law will merely bring this system into clear view. And so, in a way, I kind of support it, because at least Israel is being honest about its character as the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant, or JSIL. And you can see that it's causing a conniption fit among liberal Zionists who have always tried to maintain the fantasy that there is a democratic Israel that exists alongside the undemocratic Israel that controls the occupied territories. This fantasy has been exploded not by me or by any anti-Zionist, but by the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And so let's be honest about what Israel is.
Indeed. Well said. I'm just looking forward to seeing how people can actually defend this now that it is laid bare. Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist, author, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Always amazing to have you on. Incredible story.
Thanks a lot.
That was an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal, talking about his experience trying to speak in Germany and the attempts by the Zionists to silence him. That is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a segment of Truth and Justice Radio. And please join us again next Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.